Hello, everybody. This is Brad Foreman with Peaks Podcast. This is our 67th episode, Season 5, Everest. Over a year or two, actually 2 years in the making. We're still waiting on Everest, and we'll talk about that in a little while. Firstly, we're going to talk about Rabies Roulette. It's been about a year since our last recording, and a lot of interesting things have occurred. For the summer, we moved to our mountain training camp in Silverthorne, Colorado, Summit Peaks Lodge. This summer, we were met with quite an interesting situation. Apparently, we weren't the only residents in our 3,700-foot cabin. During the spring, some bats found cracks in the log seams, and they made it their home. We didn't know this until weeks into our trip, when we found a random bat flying in the house. I took care of it and sent him into animal control, and he tested negative. Why I'm going through this, we learned a whole bunch of interesting stuff. In Colorado, number one, it's illegal to kill a bat, but under the circumstances with a rabies potential, it was necessary, and we gave the dead bat to animal control. A couple days later, they came back with a negative rabies test. This is important because rabies have a very, very low kill rate on humans because they get vaccinated. But without a vaccination, you can die within a short period of time. Interestingly enough, animal control told me it could be as much as a year, and we should run over to the hospital and do a $15,000 inoculation vaccine. I wasn't too keen on this idea, so we held off. We found out that bats live in colonies. They're mammals, and they have a very tight colony in that they groom each other. So the grooming leads to a lot of contact, and this contact causes, if one bat is infected in the colony, most of them are, if not all, and vice versa. If you get a clean bat without any problems, the colony should be safe. Well, this is a big enough sign for me to go ahead without the expensive vaccinations, and I'm not a big vaxxer anyhow. So then, a week later, another bat in the lodge. I do the same process, bring them to Colorado Animal Control. 3 days later, negative. So I'm feeling good. I didn't have contact with the bat. Another week, another bat, another trip to animal control, and it proves that the third bat is negative. Big relief, a lot of anxiety, and you know, you're literally playing the game of life and death. You guessed it. The date was September 11th, infamous date in history, and our caretaker notified me that she saw a bat in our common area. I said, hold on, take cover, I'll come out. And so I had a towel with me. The bat was in a high rafter, so I knocked the bat down, and in the process, the bat came very close to me, and then I knocked him outside of the common area into the outdoors. Could not be retrieved. So I had 3 negative tests, a 4th one with possible contact, no test. So this wasn't exactly the best, and I was much more concerned about this because on my elbow there was a 2 open wound, slightly open, very, very slight, maybe a millimeter incision, about 2 millimeters apart. So I didn't feel bad, and I didn't tell anybody about the contact, but in fact, I did not see this bat. You know, I couldn't bring him to animal control. So this was a concern. I left the next day on a wedding crusade of 3 weddings in 3 weeks, and I just kind of kept it to myself. So every time I felt a possible symptom like saliva or irritability, I was super concerned that I had actually been infected. But the days and weeks went by. I got back down to Florida. We had a boat coming in to replace the boat that sunk, Summit Seas. So we had to be down here, got down here and visited my local doctor. And he informed me that there's absolutely no way a month afterwards, if I didn't have any symptoms, that I could be infected. And he said this with the utmost confidence. And we came to the conclusion that maybe the animal control, besides CYAing themselves, might have been pushing people to the hospital to get these super expensive vaccinations. I don't have proof of that, but I'm always a conspiracy theorist, and this one played right into my book. I'm happy to report Russian roulette didn't kill this time. And we were super lucky. So now we're back in Florida. I'm actually doing this podcast from the flybridge of our new boat. And super excited to replace our boat, which I had to do. And it wasn't easy. I want to talk about some of the impacts of Ian. 390 days after it struck on September 28th, 2021, we achieved a permit. Now that might not seem like much, but our lower level was decimated. We couldn't rebuild until we get this permit. The process down here is exhausting. It pushes every resident to their last nerve. I don't know how older people can fight through this because it's just so difficult. So we got our permit. Now we have to go and have our general contractor start. And it might be as soon as 60 days and we'll be back up and running. We have a triplex down here. We live in one of the units, and we have 2 others for rent. One is actually ready to rent now that we have our permit, and the lower level, which is a 3-bedroom, will hopefully be ready for season coming up in the next couple months. The process down here has been a super important education. You never want to have a property in a disaster area. Possibly rethink that purchase and make sure you're prepared to deal with a very complicated situation. I talked in my previous podcast episode 66 about the insurance companies and the shenanigans that they play. We got 85% coverage on our boat. We got 97% coverage on flood. But one of the biggest policies, wind, we only received 15%. A total scam. They basically try to not pay and hold you at hostage, especially the independents. I figured out after 8 months I was in trouble and couldn't fight them myself. So I lawyered up. In future episodes, I'll let you know how that goes, but we're probably looking at, you know, a bunch of money if they are successful. And hopefully the small guy, me, wins. And we'll be able to make our place even better than it was before the hurricane. This insurance thing down here is probably as devastating as the hurricane. I have many friends that lost everything, and to them I have the deepest sympathy for the struggles. Lost friends over this situation, made some great friends. All in all, it was probably one of the most difficult years of my life. And it was similar to climbing any of the five summits that I've accomplished. You know, there's a lot of work that goes in beforehand, and then you have to get after it once you get on that. And this hurricane proved a very similar challenge. We're going to move right into the Colorado bucket list. Of course, a year ago, during the hurricane, when it was hitting, actually, the exact day it hit, I was on the Snuffles Traverse. That's episode 66. If you haven't listened to it, it's a good one. In episode 67, right here, we had the trifecta for Colorado, the trifecta bucket list. And we're going to talk about that today. The first portion of the bucket list is a trip that I've been eyeballing for 30 years. It's a beautiful hike from the town of Aspen, outside of Aspen, over to Crested Butte. This is a hike that goes several thousand vertical feet and over 11 miles, starting at the beautiful Maroon Lake and then ending up over at the trailhead in outside of Crested Butte. To do this, you know, you gotta have some logistics fall into place. And that's really an important part of this whole exercise. Our team met in Aspen the night before, and we had two vehicles that had to be shuttled over to the other side of the pass. Now, we're only going 11 to 14 miles. The cars had to go 100 and some miles to get to the other trailhead. So we had hired a service to do that. So we would just go one way and then out. And the area is so popular. Maroon Lake is like world famous. It has views that are just stunning. The Maroon Bells reflecting down on the surface. And there's only one way in. And the road's about 10 miles. It's such a blast from the past. Right at the before the lake, there's a ranch that's been there for 40, 50 years. And we holidayed there for 15 years. And that place is known as Tea Lazy Seven. Tea Lazy Seven is still there. And that's where the road is blocked off after 8 a.m. to all traffic except for authorized commercial. So we have to get up to the trailhead before then. So we have a truly an alpine start in the wee hours of the morning and get all equipped, load in a transit van, and drive up past T-Lazy 7. T-Lazy 7 has a really colorful history. The lady, she was a movie star in the black and white era named Lou Dean. And if you look her up, she's was a beautiful woman. We stayed there and she'd literally feed her dogs steaks. And my young age, it was like, I couldn't believe that they're giving the dog, you know, $20, $30 steaks every meal. But she was a classic, and we'd stay there and then hike all around the area and ski. It was always winter, New Year's to Christmas. So driving by there just made a smile on my face, thinking of her and the family. Anyhow, we get to the trailhead. There are a number of people. It's a super popular place, and it books out, you know, so there's only a limited amount of people that can get up in there. And we're at the trailhead, and to my surprise, the lake is quite low. It's probably 10 to 15 feet or 25% dry. This is a big issue because the fish population and the whole ecosystem is damaged in that kind of event. I don't know how long this has been. I haven't been up here in 10, 15 years, so it caught me off guard. But I'm sure it impacts the trout fishing, because the stream coming in is just a trickle. So we get hiking, and for those of you who know, September in the Rockies at 10,000 feet, you know, we have brilliant aspen foliage all around us. We follow up this stream bed all the way towards the pass. We pass one other lake, which is almost dry. And it was just very, very difficult to see. The trail we're on is called West Maroon Creek. And they say it's only 11 miles, but my Garmin and my Fitbit both said 14 to 18 miles. So be that as it may, I might have done a little extra credit around the sides. As we hike up the trail, there's, you know, we're passing back and forth with a couple groups. And this one fellow had boots on. I noticed when we passed him, and I said, hey, you know, you're wearing Hokas? And he goes, yeah, we just got them. And I said, oh my gosh, I've been to Everest Base Camp in these. I've never seen anybody with these. And I didn't recognize that guy. He had a beautiful wife and two bodyguard-looking guys next to him. So up the trail a little further, one of my buddies that we climb with said, you know, that guy you're talking to is Greg Kinnear. And I'm like, yeah, who is that? And he explained that that was the actor in Little Miss Sunshine and a whole bunch of other movies, and I just was laughing. I wouldn't have known him if I saw him in a group of two and was asked which one is Greg. But a super nice guy, and only on the trail out of Aspen would you run into such a fellow. He was quite witty, and we ran across his trail, passing back and forth a couple times during the day. The whole passage was super fun. I'm coming from sea level on two weddings. It was a little exhausting to me, but, you know, it was a great way to start out the trifecta, the Colorado bucket list trifecta. We took about 8 hours, so that even confirms that the 16 mile might be a little closer, or 14 to 16, because we were at a pretty good pace. It's only carrying, you know, 20, 30 pounds. So we had most of our gear stuck in the transport vehicles. And We made it down to the other side, the trailhead, and had a little celebration with the different people we've met. And got out of our sweaty boots and sweaty shirts. Quickly changed because we had a couple hour drive down to our destination in Ridgeway. They were doing a bunch of construction. And if you don't make it through by 7 p.m., you have to possibly do another hour and a half trip around the construction. So we were really concerned about this. So we didn't waste much time, stopping for a beverage on the way out. We just drove through and we made it through the construction area heading south down to Ridgeway. We spend the night in Ridgeway, outside of Ridgeway, and we provision up the whole next day. And we also tackle number two on the bucket list, which you'll hear about in a minute. Thanks again for listening to Pot Peaks Podcast. I just want to refresh your memories. If you didn't know, we do this, all monies that we earn are given to kids in need, whether it be in Colorado, Quad Cities, or down in Florida. 100% of the proceeds go to this. And we also are trying to promote to any listeners to get outside and enjoy the outdoors. All these adventures hopefully stimulate some interest in getting out there. Thanks for listening to Peaks Podcast, and we're going to continue in just a moment. Okay, here we go. So we're on the second prong of our trifecta. That's True Grit. True Grit is a movie filmed 50 years ago for anybody that might not be familiar with this. It's a Western. It features John Wayne, Glenn Campbell, etc. It's probably one of the my dad's favorite Western, so it became mine because we watch it so much. It's filmed in Ridgeway, Colorado. Therein lies our second bucket list item. My climbing buddy is a True Grit fanatic, living in Ridgeway. He has studied a lot of the information on shooting sites, which, you know, is famous for, that's where it was filmed, Ridgeway, Colorado. So he springs on us in the morning when we wake up, hey, let's go find the snake pit. Okay, the snake pit is a scene where this girl is knocked into a snake pit and by a villain, and then rescued by Glenn Campbell, and then eventually John Wayne. So it's like the crux. I mean, in my worst dreams, I think about the snake pit. This snake pit is, could be one of the most horrible things. So she gets knocked in, you know, imagine 40s, 30s. Anyhow, she gets knocked into the snake pit, and there are rattlesnakes in this pit, and it's 20 feet deep. So the snake pit is in this area. So, I mean, because it was my adolescent haunt, I mean, I'm like thinking, this would be the coolest thing in the planet to see. So I've heard about it from my climbing buddy multiple times, and I just wrote it off, you know, was there or not, didn't know. So apparently, between then and my trip, he discovered new information. He said it, he had it identified within a couple square mile area. So I'm thinking, wow, this is a good probability. Maybe we got it. However, I didn't have any, I wasn't super optimistic. I think I took the under on the find 50%, which we always bet on things. Okay, so we go into town, we do our typical thing, you know, one of our people have to buy stuff. I just can't wait to get up there to this alleged trailhead that leads possibly to an area. So we finally get out of town. I'm on a trigger with these people shopping. I just want to get out. So we get out of town. So it's up in this canyon. So you drive up into this canyon and we leave our car kind of like on the entrance to an old mining road-ish. I mean, I don't know how better to describe it, but wasn't really anything. It wasn't designated. And we start walking it. We walk up. And the directions were a mile. So we you know, calculate approximately a mile. And then it's, we took pictures from the movie. Oh gosh, I forgot this segment. Let's jump back. At the house before we left on this adventure, Bucket 2, we watched True Grit scenes and then took pictures of the specific snake pit so we could get the landscape topography. This is important because when you see like little mounds behind the snake pit, etc., or what turns out to be the telltale item, they came up in the photos that we took from the movie on the screen. So anyhow, we proceed up this trail and, you know, approximately a mile. And so I decide to go off trail. Off trail, I'm thinking, there's nothing going to be on trail. And I take the left side of the trail, as I recall. And I find a mining trench and start following that. It's a little rugged. No big deal. Keep following it. You know, I'm getting more excited because, you know, mining, they have pits. And I can feel my heart rate getting higher and higher. I mean, abnormally high. I mean, I don't get this excited about much, but I would love to find this. And so going up, and it's looking more like the terrain I saw in the movie. Well, then I climb over this rise, and there's this mining area, and then there's a pit. Now my heart's racing. I'm at 140. racing. And I look over and I see these rocks that are like fake rocks. And that was the giveaway. Right there, Hollywood, they made fake rocks to make the embankment for the pit. And I knew we had found it. I was so excited. After all these years and hearing about this place from my buddy, didn't pay that much attention, but the connection between my buddy's love for this movie and my dad's, oh my gosh, unbelievable. So I wasn't even sure if this was it because it was so weathered and broken down, but we went around and looked around the area just to make see if there's anything else better. And while I was doing that and a couple friends, my buddy found a fellow that verified that this was the location. He was a land owner in the area that had intel. And so that was our number two. Now for the third bucket list item. Over the last 20 years, 30 years, some of our climbing team have looked out of their homes down in the San Juans and seen these two peaks towering along the skyway. First is White House, and the second is Ridgeway, side by side. A year ago, we had tried for both of them, but we got turned around because of heavy snows the night before our climb was scheduled. This time, it looks like the weather is in our favor. So, we're in a good position for success. As mentioned, we take a day off to provision up, making sure we have the right meals because we'll be backpacking in and spending a night and then coming out after summiting the next day is the tentative plan. So food prep's important. We need to get a dinner, a breakfast, lunch, possibly two lunches. So we lay out all the food as usual on the living room floor, getting piles for each person to carry in. It doesn't sound like a tricky process, but it's super important because I've seen trips get really uncomfortable when the food prep's not there. We also have common gear. There are tents, there are stoves to contend with. So we split this gear up, and each person is carrying their allotted amount. We wake up early the next morning and move to the trailhead. The trailhead name is Weehawken. Kind of an interesting name. And I never really heard a reason. I'm guessing it's Indian origin, local Indian. The approach is rather steep. We do 3,000 vertical up this river valley in 4 miles distance. I'm carrying around 50 pounds, so once again, as I mentioned, getting into the altitude after sea level for only 48 hours does not have me acclimatized for this. I literally sweated, I'm guessing, 5 pounds of water weight during this little exercise. I'll say, though, the trail was just spectacular. you have very, very steep ridges that we're contouring across with falls of over 100 feet. So any mistake would be most likely death. So attention had to be put on every step. And that's more exhausting sometimes than the carry. But anyhow, we traversed our way up, crossing streams. Didn't have to take off shoes, so it was not difficult. You know, when you got to start taking out your shoes and socks and fording a stream, that can be a real tedious task. So we get up to a high valley. We do have a couple local guides joining us, and it's a good idea that we had them because they were able to, well, they scouted the trail. The trail is not climbed very often, and as we find out later, only 16 in the last couple years were on the ledger. We have this camp, and it's picturesque as can be. A big open valley. It's a hanging valley. And we're on the side of the valley. Campfires are allowed, so that's a bonus. After we get tents set up, we start the cooking process. Now, this is quite fun because the two guides, they had four stoves. And I brought one and another colleague brought one. So we fired up six stoves. And it was hilarious. You see them all lined up. We were able to put out a dinner in no time at all with hot drinks, soups. And the whole process was, I'm guessing, less than a half hour. We had a boil off, and my stove came in second, so I was happy with that since it's an older model. I've probably had it 10 years, and it's been all over the world with me, and it's still kicking. So that was fun. We get to bed early. You know, it's up at, we're at about 10,000 feet, maybe a little higher, and so, you know, I don't sleep that well when I go from zero to that elevation. But the camp was perfect. My pad setup was very comfortable. I did have a snoring tent mate, but if that's the worst thing that happened to me, no problem. The thing that was an issue is we had a super full moon. So about 9:40, when the moon peeked over the horizon, it was so bright, my grandfather used to say you could read a newspaper, and that was the case on this full moon. I literally had to put my sleeping bag over my head so I could block out some of the moonbeam. We didn't put the tarp on the tent because it was so clear and no chance of rain. So it was fun to sleep under the stars. Haven't done that in a while. It did get a little brisk, though, midnight, and I ended up pulling out my down parka and throwing it over the top, giving me enough insulation to make my sleep nice and comfortable. I wake up at the crack of dawn, literally before sunrise. My usual exercises to prepare coffee, so I ran over to the kitchen area, and the guides had already been prepping some stuff, and I fired up the stoves and got some coffee, which is kind of a tradition that I deliver it to each of the tents, and I only had instant coffee, so it was a little disappointing for me, but, you know, I had zero preparation time coming in from these weddings I had mentioned, so all's well that ends well. Once we broke camp, we had to pack things up to some degree because when after summiting, we're going to come back to camp, continue the last portions of packing, and then carry out a huge day by any measure.
we wind up the valley. I actually take a lead on a trail targeting White House first. One of the guides kind of pointed out to me verbally and directionally where the trailhead goes. Pretty much stayed on point on the correct trailhead through most of it, and it was just spectacular. We moved above tree line quite quickly. White House is 13,492 feet above sea level. We all kind of rendezvous in the saddle before the last pitch. And the last pitch is maybe a 3-2 scramble, but it's my nemesis, the dreaded scurry, the loose rock. Every footstep you take, the rocks are moving underneath you, and it's very easy to kick out a boulder and have a big problem for anybody below. So you try to crisscross the couloir so that any falling rock wouldn't be directly on one of your teammates. This technique is not guaranteed by any stretch of the imagination, but it does make for a little bit safer of a climb. I find myself winded going up through the couloir, and then of course we had the dreaded three or four false summits, but not too much past midday we summited White House. The views are spectacular. We look back at the ranch we were staying at from the summit. Unbelievable. I was really happy on the summit, as I always am, but this one particularly felt good with the minimal preparation. I was a little tired, and I felt not as strong as usual for the second climb. If anybody would have declined it, I would have probably not put up a fight. Ridgeway is almost as high as White House at 13,468 feet above sea level. It's a climb down of 1,000 at least, and then back up the ridge of Ridgeway. And that was a little steep, and once again, loose rock. Not as bad as White House, but still loose rock. We do it quite surprisingly in maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. So I was impressed. And once again, the views were incredible on this summit. One of the funny things, we were taking pictures on the top, and the updraft from the valley was carrying aspen leaves, bright yellow leaves in the updraft. So a place where you'd never see a leaf, they were just flying up this wind tunnel. Very, very pretty. So basically, we have about 4,000 vertical in 3 miles, plus 6,000 vertical down over 6 miles to the East Mesa. A huge day, and I'm feeling it at the end. This is where you got to pay super attention to your body signals and pay close attention to your ankles and steps, because for me, this is when I have a problem and can get hurt. But we make it all the way down, and it's a huge day. Everybody's exuberantly excited because it's a little touch and go there for a while. It was a long down climb, 6 miles. It doesn't sound like much, but in this terrain, it was a big day. Anyhow, happy to report all three bucket list items were knocked out this trip. It'd been a year in waiting since we missed White House, and it felt extremely rewarding. The last part of this podcast, I want to review where I am at with Everest. It's November 2023. Everest has been a target for several years now. There is a possibility that our climbing guides have secured just a handful of permits to climb the north route through China. Now, China and the U.S. relations right now are horrible. So, once again, I'm dealing with, you know, commit, train, and the possibility of having the plug pulled on the summit day, literally. So it's kind of a difficult decision, but I have been training, and I picked up training over the last couple months to be ready if this opportunity comes through. I'm being told it would be a team of three climbers, myself being one, so that size group is perfect, especially in that I know one of the climbers intimately, and he's strong. The guide is lead guide for many of my climbs, so I'm comfortable, very comfortable with that. So it's just this nagging problem with the U.S. and China relations that's eating away at me right now. But I've upped my training to 4 to 5 miles, 45-pound pack, in Colorado in the mountains, and down here at the southern camp, Fort Myers, 4.5 on the beach, which is a good little workout. You break a good sweat, and so all in all, I just want to be prepared if this opportunity comes. It's been a tough 2023 with all the issues I've covered in this podcast, but I can say confidently I'm a better person for living and working through all these challenges. It's been a real growth and learning experience for me. Thank you for listening to Peaks Podcast. Our goal is to encourage everyone listening to get out there and exercise and get out in the Mother Nature. All and any monies raised by this podcast, 100% go to Kids in Need. You can see my website, which will be listed in the podcast. You can find my podcast on most all platforms out there, Apple, Spotify. And once again, we're really proud to be upgraded to the Spotify direct podcast platform. It's a biggie, and I think we're going to have a lot more visibility in the coming episodes. Thanks for listening. This is Brad, Peaks Podcast. Have a great day.